Hello, I'm Keith Perron. Welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. Amnesty International has accused Australia of abandoning asylum seekers and refugees on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island and says the government needs to resettle them somewhere else soon. The organization released a new report last week saying hundreds of men were moved from the hellish situation to another last November in an act of reassembling punishment rather than protection. The report's author, Kate Schultz, compiled the work after the men were forcibly removed from their old detention center to a newer one, but reportedly unfinished facilities near the island's main town of Lorago. Ms. Schultz told Kuroro Vakuatu the research was based on interviews with 55 refugees and asylum seekers.
We spoke to a wide range of refugees, asylum seekers, people living in the community, the local police as well. We heard lots of reports from refugees themselves. Either they themselves had been assaulted or robbed in town or knew of someone else who had been. Those reports were fairly consistent and people said to us that because they're perceived as foreigners, they stand out in the local community, that often makes them an easy target for theft and robbery and other violence. In addition, in Lorengau, you've got the situation where there's increasing tension with the local community who weren't consulted about these changes. There are real concerns now about how these new sites have been managed or mismanaged. And, you know, it seems like a system of organised chaos designed to confuse and confound and sort of trap these refugees in prolonged limbo there. I think the important part of this report is highlighting that the situation hasn't substantially changed from what it was prior to the 31st of October last year. The Australian government has removed them from one prison-like camp to several others.
How would you describe from your interviews with over 50 refugees and asylum seekers the environment at the new site? Because there were always concerns that it wasn't ready for accommodations.
We visited each of the sites. Obviously, they weren't so open in terms of letting us walk around the facilities, but you could see from the outside perimeter the site of Hillside House and West Lorengau. It was very clearly still a construction site at the time we were there in early November. There's no recreation facility. Just excavated land between two separated buildings that are around 500 metres apart that the refugees can walk between. There's no secure perimeter fence still. We know that because UNHCR has continued to go to the island and report on this stuff. There's not enough toilets, showers, laundry facilities to adequately provide for the health and sanitation of the men. And we've also got the reports from the locals about open sewage runoff onto neighbouring land, which is increasing tensions. We also have a standoff between two rival security companies, both wanting money from the Australian government. All of this leaves refugees in a very precarious situation and a very hostile environment.
I understand that they've even been advised, although there's not an official curfew, to get back to their accommodations at certain time.
So, I mean, essentially we have the Australian government on the one hand saying they're not detained anymore, they're free to leave during the day, but then they're telling them at the same time it's not safe for them to leave and it's particularly not safe for them to leave at particular time. These people are essentially confined to Manus Island, confined to living at those refugee centres. Many of these people have been assessed as refugees, around 600 or so of the 800 men, and they're no closer to getting freedom of movement in the country, the right to work, the right to move on with their lives in freedom and safety.
This obviously has taken a huge toll on these refugees and asylum seekers as well in terms of psychologically.
So we do have in-depth studies released by the UNHCR as well as other medical experts who visited. Around 88% of refugees and asylum seekers sent to Manus and Nauru are now suffering from serious depressive and anxiety disorders. And a large part of this doesn't arise from the reason which they fled their countries. It arises from the way they've been treated, locked up in this way.
So what do you hope to achieve with the release of this report?
We wanted to do a couple of things. One is to debunk the theory that the Australian government was closing the centre to comply with the court order. That's absolute nonsense. The court order said that it was illegal to send these people to PNG and detain them there. They're still in largely the same situation they were. But I think also it's important to say that PNG is never going to be a viable option for the settlement of refugees. They've struggled able to settle West Papuans who are considered Melanesian brothers, and they have that affiliation with them. Refugees have been treated so poorly and dehumanised in Papua New Guinea that any form of meaningful integration efforts now are probably going to be unsuccessful.
The dengue-related fever death of a 12-year-old girl in Tonga has highlighted the need for more awareness of the disease throughout the region. Tonga is the latest Pacific country to declare a dengue outbreak, which has so far been isolated to the main island of Tongatapu. Dominic Godfrey reports.
The 12-year-old was visiting family in Tonga for the Christmas holidays and was expected back in New Zealand for the start of the new school year. Instead, she came home to be buried. Her uncle in New Zealand, Viliami Latsu, says she was taken to hospital three times before the flu diagnosis changed.
When they went back the third time, they were asked to stay in the hospital overnight. They did some blood tests and a few other things on that night, but I think they quickly found out that it was dengue fever.
Mr. Latu says she died 4 hours after being diagnosed. A different uncle says another Tongan New Zealander has returned home to Auckland with dengue, and another girl from Tonga has been sent home to England after being diagnosed last month. He says she collapsed while going through customs and immigration in London, bleeding from the nose and mouth. Tonga's health ministry advises the number of people with the disease has reached 33 and will climb further. Its chief executive, Dr. Siali Akaola, says prior to the outbreak, there had only been sporadic cases of dengue brought in by others from around the region, and the New Zealand girl was among the first confirmed local cases.
There was no real general awareness that dengue was already in Tonga. We thought that it was a flu-like illness initially. Their family did actually bring the kid to hospital. It's a very unfortunate oversight in my view. In hindsight, I guess we are smarter now. All the cases of fever, we are suspecting dengue.
Dengue shows severe flu-like symptoms, including fever, headache, muscular and joint pain, nausea, vomiting and swollen glands. It can lead to dengue shock syndrome, which results in bleeding, circulatory collapse and potentially death. Dr. Akaola says the main vector of the disease is a mosquito known for living and breeding near people's houses.
Most of them would breed in the gutters of houses, water tanks, or even rubbish that are lying about. So one of the ways to prevent, to reduce the breeding site is really a general cleanup.
Health authorities have kicked an eradication campaign into gear, focusing on breeding grounds around Tongatapu. Mosquito nets and insect repellent are being distributed, especially to homes with infected people, so as to avoid insects biting them and spreading the disease to others. New Zealand's Minister of Pacific Peoples, Aupito Williams-Sio, says there's another contributing factor to the spread of dengue in the region.
With climate change, you'll find that scientists are now saying that the Pacific region has become really ripe for the breeding of mosquitoes that carry all these diseases as a result of warmer, wetter, hotter seasons.
Aupito is calling for greater regional awareness about the risk of dengue, saying public health authorities have lots of information available internally, which needs to be more effectively communicated.
I am keen to see information available to any traveller made available at the airport, because that's really the point where people need to be told, here's potentially what could happen in the Pacific. You need to take precautions. And I think that's still missing at this point.
Aupito says it's critical that regional governments work together on containing diseases, as Pacific people are a very mobile community that often call more than one country home. The Pacific Public Health Surveillance Network says it's been notified of Tonga's dengue outbreak and has communicated this to governments and health authorities throughout the region. New Zealand's health ministry is in the process of developing dengue warnings in the languages of Fiji, Samoa and Tonga for use in social media and online. This is Dominic Godfrey.
New Zealand's foreign minister has underlined the importance of maintaining a strong presence in the Pacific Islands region. 9 years since his last stint as foreign minister, Winston Peters resumed the role last year in a new Labour-led government. Mr. Peters was interviewed by Chris Wikara, who asked his views about influence in the Pacific.
We're just going to have to pull our weight more on supporting our staff, our resources in foreign affairs, and when it comes to foreign aid, we are not looking good at all. We're heading down to 0.22, 0.21. That's a long way. Well, you know, the worldwide goal is 0.7. If the UK can afford 0.7, why are we heading to 0.21? What does it mean? Well, if you exit theatres, somebody will fill the gap, and they may not be good for both those populations and for New Zealand as well.
Mm. When you were a foreign affairs minister last time, you spent a lot of time in the Pacific. The US presence was nowhere near as strong. The Chinese presence was nowhere near as strong. Do you see a tangible difference there? How much pressure are our Pacific Island cousins coming under?
Well, they're coming under a lot of pressure and a lot of enticements and a lot of temptations as to how certain politicians individually might act and might take in terms of options. I don't want to repeat another politician from another country who somewhat upset all the Pacific people recently, but we've made it very clear that we have a lot of Pacific people in New Zealand who work two and three jobs and pay taxes, and they don't mind our aid programs in the Pacific. But the least they expect the Pacific people to do is to follow democratic best principled governments and not be corrupt.
Some work to do there? Who do you think needs to do the most work there?
Well, we all have to. We've got to get more politicians out there in terms of creating better societies, in terms of ensuring that there's better transparency and accountability. There's some serious success stories in the Pacific with governments, and things are going well, but there are some very serious stories there where the pressures and temptations of outside influences show some negative outcomes.
Who would you put up as the example of doing it the best?
Well, I hope it's us. I hope it's New Zealand that's the best influence here. At least we've got the United States thinking again about the Pacific. That's the reason why we got Condoleezza Rice here for the first time anybody bothered to come to the Pacific, way back about 10 years ago. And we reminded them that this is a huge theatre. And you've left for a long time. It's start time to show some influence. And the good news is that the UK is starting to show some renewed interest as well.
A bill to ban the sale and distribution of plastic straws in the United States of Hawaii is gathering support. The bill, sponsored by Senator Carl Rhodes, passed the Committee on Agriculture and Environment last week, despite resistance from some food and drink businesses. Amanda Kelly from the Hawaii Association of Behavioral Analysts says straws are reportedly be among the top 10 items polluting the ocean. She told Sara Viatulu that plastic pollution doesn't easily disintegrate and harms ocean wildlife.
So this bill was proposed by Senator Rhodes, and looking at the Senate Committee on Agriculture and Environment, I think a lot of what is driving the need for that is there's a large amount of trash in our oceans, and obviously Hawaii is an island state, and the trash is arriving on our beaches. We see it, you know, we do a lot of beach cleanups. We see it when we have large surf, and, you know, it comes to a point where you can continue to pick up the trash, but we have a finite amount of resources. And so what happens to that trash if we just continue to consume it is it's just going to continue to consume us.
Why target straws in particular?
You know, one of the reasons why straws are an easy target is just the sheer amount of them that are used per day. In the United States, there's over 500 million estimated use per day. The average person, they say, in the U.S. uses 1.6, which is almost like 585 straws in a year. And there are, you know, filtration systems and filters that look to catch trash before it goes into our streams and oceans. But straws are unique because of their shape. So they're very narrow and they kind of fit through small holes in a lot of those filtration systems. And the research suggests that straws are within the top 10 items floating around in our ocean.
And I guess a straw is a one-use thing most of the time?
I think really this bill is targeting the single-use plastic straws, and so there are other alternatives. There are single-use corn or plant-based straws. There are single-use paper straws. Obviously, I think the bigger picture should be on looking at having less single-use items, But personally, I think plastic is more dangerous because it's difficult, you know, upon creation. And then once we're done with it, it doesn't break down the way that a paper or a plant-based material might. Reusable straws, though, if you're looking into those, there are a plethora of options as well. There are really thick glass, strong glass ones. There are bamboo, metal straws, and, you know, it's personal preference, I think, for the reusable straws.
So a lot of the big food chains are guilty of using these types of straws. Would that be an ethical choice for them, big business perhaps, to do the switch with straws?
I think, you know, we saw opposition when the bill was heard from the restaurant industry. You know, it's going to cost us a lot of money. What do we do about replacements? What happens if our customers are unhappy? And I think, you know, from my experiences, and I had started a group online, what we found was that customers stay happy, especially if you explain to them what the reason is or if you provide alternatives for them. For individuals who might need a straw for, you know, medical reasons or who have another reason for needing that straw, I think there's, again, those alternatives that could be available.
So it's past the committee stage. So what's the remaining passage for this bill?
So this bill would need to be, you know, referred on. It did pass with no amendments or reservations, which is a strong indication of its support legislatively. We find that, obviously, that committee will often vote in favor of environmental issues due to the fact that that's their committee. But it will cross over from the Senate side to the House side, and there is an opportunity typically for more testimony as long as it's scheduled. So we'll be keeping a close look on the calendar there. Just in general, I would tell people, pick one thing to try to change. As an individual, we have a lot of power. I think policy and legislation can really help us magnify what we are trying to set out to do. But creating awareness typically is the first place to start. When I learned 500 million in a day in the United States, that was really hard to wrap my head around, and I thought, I got to do something.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A single civil registration network has been established to ensure stronger data on sharing birth, deaths, marriages around the Pacific. The Pacific Civil Registrations Network is part of the global movement to increase registrations of vital events, as globally nearly half of the 128 million babies born each year go unregistered. The network looks after 19 countries in the region, and New Zealand's Registrar General Jeff Montgomery spoke to Senator Jane Hopgood on the need for it.
There's a global drive to increase the number of people who have got legal identities, so have had their birth registered, and we're part of that global movement. So we formed to make sure that the Pacific voice was heard locally, but also internationally when we're discussing matters around civil registration, birth, death and marriages.
How does it compare with the current systems in place in the Pacific?
Well, each country has its own birth registration system, and some countries do very well at that, and other countries are really just starting out. So the idea of the network was to help everybody improve their systems in their own countries, but also to look at how we share information, particularly for people who migrate from perhaps a Pacific island country to Australia or New Zealand or to another island, so that their information can travel with them. So if somebody from the Cook Islands, who's born in the Cook Islands, dies in Auckland, then the New Zealand Birth, Death and Marriages Office, so my office, will send the details of that person's death back to the Cook Islands so it can be matched up with their birth record. It happens automatically. The family don't need to do anything.
How is the information, the data that is recorded, useful for other public sectors?
The main use of sharing the data is to help countries plan their public services and also to manage things and identify things in the health area that might be important. So we know that a number of people from the islands might go to Australia or New Zealand for medical care, and they may die in that country. So by sharing the information back with the birth country, that country can use that to look at any health issues that may be emerging in their community, and also to plan health facilities in their own country.
And so data sharing agreements have already started with Cook Island, Niue, Tokelau, right?
The main reason is that there's already a close working relationship between New Zealand and those Pacific countries, and also they're active members of the Pacific Civil Registrars Network. So we decided to start with those countries that are relatively small and have quite good civil registry systems. So the Cook Islands in particular has got a very effective birth and death registration system. So it was easy for New Zealand and the Cook Islands to connect. And it also was easy for Tokelau and Niue because we have very similar laws and ways of operating. The next step is to look at those other countries and to look at sharing information with other Pacific countries, Australia and New Zealand.
Children's rights are at the heart of a training program being run for judges and magistrates in Fiji this week. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is participating with Fiji's judiciary to ensure the protection of children when they are in contact with the judicial system. UNICEF's Pacific representative, Sheldon Yett, spoke to Dominic Godfrey about how the judicial system can further traumatize children if child-sensitive training and procedures are not in place.
Sometimes people assume that children are just like adults. And of course, we know they're not. We know that the level of maturity and the level of development in children is very different. So in order for a child to have his or her full right of protection fully met, it's important that the people that interact with them understand this and have specific training and procedures in place in institutions in which they work. It doesn't matter if the health system, the education system, or the judicial system.
Indeed. What about the media?
Absolutely. The same thing, of course. The media, too. Very specific measures have to be in place when dealing with children, particularly in children in contact with the law.
I note this because a couple of years ago there was a terrible case in Fiji where a girl was raped and murdered in Pacific Harbour, and her name was immediately in the media. It struck me because nothing was done by the judiciary to block her name from going into the media. The media didn't have anything in place to stop this and protect the child and her family.
Yes, it's extremely important. That's why we spend a lot of time also working with editors and publishers and people in media to understand what their responsibilities are as well. Everybody has a responsibility to ensure the needs of children are met.
So these judges and magistrates, there are 41 of them doing this training and they come from throughout Fiji. What specifically is the format of the training? What are they going to be going through?
Sure. It's 3 days worth of training, so it's quite intense. It starts with talking about the stages of development of a child, how a child's brain develops, and how children are different from adults. It goes through the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the fundamental document that governs protection for children. It talks about the obligations of government agencies, the obligations of the judiciary. It talks about best practices in other countries. Our participants will have a chance to talk about what they've seen, what they're experiencing. We'll have a chance to talk with psychologists and with lawyers and with practitioners from around the world. So it's an opportunity for them to be honest and open and learn about best practices elsewhere in the world and learn about really what their obligations are under UN treaties.
Children and women, they're the most vulnerable of the groups of people, and made even more so in times of crisis, in times of natural disaster. Fiji itself goes through natural disasters, crises of various sorts at various stages. It has done a lot and recently. And this, of course, makes children more vulnerable than ever to assault, to crimes against them, perpetrated against them. How is this going to help?
Well, absolutely. I think it's important to know that the number of children in contact with the law has gone up. And that's for a number of reasons. People are more familiar with the issues of child abuse, why it's such a problem for children, and the services available. And that's why it's so important for judges and others in the judicial system to understand what their obligations are. And this does give them the training and give them the skills necessary to work with children.
So when a child is talking to the judiciary, to a judge, for example, to get the best and the least traumatic way out of a child, is this part of what this is going to do?
Absolutely. I mean, this is very simple things and simple principles that need to be kept in mind. For example, a child victim of abuse should not be confronted directly with the alleged perpetrator. A child shouldn't be asked to repeat over and over the story that he or she went through, because that itself can be traumatizing. There are ways of recording testimony. There are ways of separating children from the perpetrator. All these things are issues that are being discussed during the training.
How have the judges and magistrates reacted so far? Have there been any surprises amongst them? Have they been just totally open to the training?
Extremely open to the training. You know, everybody wants to do the right thing, but with all the demands on their time, it's sometimes difficult for them to learn about what best practices are elsewhere, to learn about how a child develops, to learn about some of the simple things they can do. They've been extremely open, extremely interested, and extremely engaged. We're very pleased.
You talked before about the UN Rights of the Child. Mm-hmm. What breaches have there been in the past in Fiji of the rights of the child through the judiciary?
Well, I don't want to single out Fiji. Around the world, we see breaches of it. Often children are not interviewed in an appropriate manner. They're asked to repeat their stories over and over again. Sometimes their names have been improperly released. These things happen in Fiji, but they happen around the world.
And, of course, Fiji, by going through this process, is trying to mitigate the incidences of this happening and trying to further a better process for children.
Absolutely. We are seeing very, very strong commitment from the judiciary to ensure that all the best measures are put in place, to ensure that the laws in Fiji are fully enacted and fully enforced, consistent with the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So there's certainly the will, and there's certainly a willingness to move forward and improve the situation. We're very impressed by that.
What would you like to see done across the rest of the Pacific? Is this an example that can be rolled out?
It is. I think we need to make sure that judges devote the time to it, that resources are put in place, that judges and everyone who has contact with a child really understands the unique vulnerabilities that a child faces in the court system. I mean, we know it's extremely traumatic for an adult. Put yourself in a child's shoes and you can see how bad the situation can be. Everybody needs to understand what they can do to make sure that a child does not get victimized twice. And there are simple measures, and we're glad to see that they're being put in place in Fiji.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. So until next time, I'm Keith Pellon wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Bye-bye.